Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do children learn what it means to be male or female, and what role do parents play in reinforcing or resisting the constraints of traditional gender stereotypes? Many American parents today have broader definitions of acceptable behavior for boys and girls than their own parents and grandparents did, but the children they're raising take cues about gender from a variety of sources, including the media and their peers. So how do parents come to understand the balance between nature and nurture in gendering their children and the benefits and consequences of either fighting or acquiescing to society's expectations? Emily W. Kane is professor of sociology and a member of the program in Women and Gender Studies at Bates College in Maine. Her new book is called The Gender Trap: Parents and the Pitfalls of Raising Boys and Girls. Emily, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's great to be here.
So you open the book by sharing a story about your own sons wanting a certain kind of trading cards when they were in kindergarten, which you were not crazy about because they glorified fighting. Will you tell us that story?
Oh, I'd be happy to. Part of what I write about in that section of the book is my feeling that up until that point, when they were about 5 years old, I thought I'd been doing a pretty good job keeping things neutral and discouraging them from having things that struck me as too gender typical, and the fighting-oriented playing cards struck me as, or trading cards struck me as, too typical of boyish culture, perhaps. And then one day, my partner, their dad, came to pick up one of my sons at his daycare and found him crying all alone on the floor, in the middle of the room, and he kind of choked out to his dad that nobody wanted to play with the kind of trading cards he had. And I had thought I was being clever. Parents who are listening will be a step ahead of me in knowing this was a mistake in getting him just a standard stack of playing cards, brand new, you know, when he wanted to have these trading cards. And then, of course, he discovered his peers didn't want to play with the kind of cards he had. And it really made me realize in that kind of profound personal way that I wasn't preparing him to engage with his peers successfully if I didn't at least let him carry some of those trappings of gender.
Yeah, so as you went to talk to parents about their experiences with the development of their children's attitudes about gender, you were able to relate to the fact that it's not easy, certainly for kids, but even for parents, to escape a sort of pressure to conform.
Exactly. And when I started going out to do this study in which I interviewed parents, I really expected more parents to just not be thinking about this at all, to be kind of assuming it was all fixed in nature, and then in some ways acting to reproduce typically gendered childhoods for their kids, but, you know, thinking of those actions as just reflections of nature. And I did hear that from some parents, but a lot more parents were, as you just implied, really actively managing, balancing, trying to open up new possibilities for their kids, but also worried about how their kids would be received by their peers, received by teachers, received by the adult world, if they didn't at least connect with some of the typical gender expectations.
So your use of the term gendering as a verb throughout the book indicates that this is, in fact, a process of sorts. Would you talk, though, about what the word means and remind us of the difference between gender and sex?
Sure. Well, one of the sort of standard lines that a lot of people would use teaching about sex and gender has for years been that sex is the biological foundation, male and female physiology, and that gender is a set of cultural and social expectations we, in effect, kind of lay on top of that biological foundation. But more and more in recent decades, people who think about these issues have begun to think that maybe even what we consider sex is a relatively fluid process that we fix into these couple of boxes, male and female. And I don't have to go too deep into that yet, or maybe at all, depending on what's interesting to you and anyone who calls in. But I just want to at least call into question that notion that male and female are kind of fixed in nature and then gender is only something we layer on. But certainly in our everyday lives, we think of people being sortable into males and females, boys and girls, men and women. And so then gender is used to refer to all those social and cultural rules and roles and activities and adornments and approaches that we tend to associate with those two categories. And I like your noting that use of the word gendering, because it's very much designed to draw your attention to the idea that it's a process, long and unfolding, always happening.
And it's not necessarily a conscious process.
Exactly, not necessarily at all, although I will say, again, that's one of the things that surprised me in the study. So I definitely saw a lot of unconscious gendering, a lot of parents reporting little routine activities, little comments that they weren't thinking consciously about at all, but that I would argue tend to reinforce different expectations for boys and girls, for men and women. But sometimes, too, people were surprisingly conscious of it, either conscious that they viewed it as part of their job as a parent to help prepare their kids for a gendered world, or conscious in the sense that they felt they needed to, even if they didn't want to, prepare them to a certain extent.
What's the relationship between gender and power in American society?
Oh, that's a good question. One of the things I think is really important to keep in mind when you think about gendering children and its consequences is the fact that in the adult world, we really do have power inequalities by gender. Now, I also think it's important to say that some gender inequalities really disadvantage men, and I'll come back to that in a second. Mm-hmm. But overall, most gender inequalities, the wage gap, gender differentiation in what occupations people have access to, differential obligations for household labor and childcare, sexual violence, a number of things that I could list off. In most cases, it's girls and women who have less power and less opportunity in contemporary American society. And in that sense, it's not just about whether we train boys and girls to be different. It's about whether we might be reproducing structures that systematically disadvantage girls and women in terms of their social power.
When does this work against boys and men?
Well, one of the key ways that it does is that we have this tendency, and I think a lot of us would recognize it in our day-to-day lives, to think of boys and men as less emotionally expressive, maybe even less emotionally in touch, you know, with themselves, less connective to others. And in the process, a lot of scholars of masculinity have argued, I think quite compellingly, that that often leaves boys and men without any outlet for, you know, the range of natural human emotion. And that has mental health outcomes. A lot of people think it's possible that that's one of the contributors to men's shorter lifespan than women on average. So there are various ways that that really constrains men in general. And then, of course, any man who doesn't happen to fit that stereotype, that typical mold, also faces some potential negative feedback for that as well.
So, Emily, obviously, much of what we're talking about today plays out over a lifetime for most people. What made you decide to focus this investigation on the beliefs and the experiences of preschool parents?
Well, I was particularly interested in that age range of 3 years old to 5 years old, because most psychologists argue it's around two and really solidifying by about three that kids become very conscious of gender categories out there and of their own gender identity. And anybody who's a parent or works with kids will recognize this kind of exchange that sometimes comes up where you try to tell, say, a 3 or 4 year old, you know, girls can do this too or boys can do that too, and they'll say, no, they can't. Because from their perspective, in their social world, these rules seem very fixed. So I was interested in that age where kids are becoming very conscious of different expectations for boys and girls, and an age where parents are in really active kind of negotiation with their kids, right? You could look at the way we gender infants, and I do write a little bit about that in the book and talk to parents a little bit about that, but that's when the child is pretty passive, right? So we might put pink on the girl and blue on the boy, but they're not resisting. By 3, 4, and 5 years old, they're an active participant in that process together with their parents.
You know, the clothing thing is so interesting, especially on infants, because, you know, sometimes people give us clothes, sometimes we choose clothes. Some parents will say, well, I put my daughter in pink and my son in blue so that people automatically know she's a girl or he's a boy. And the question there is, why is that so important that strangers be able to know this instantly about an infant?
Yes, isn't that interesting? And I definitely talked to parents who reported exactly that. I even talked to parents who said they'd started out putting their child in relatively neutral colors, and then if it was a girl, everyone assumed it was a boy because we associate those neutral colors more with boys, and then they would begin to feel that it prompted awkward social interactions. Hmm. And so even if they didn't want to kind of ornament their daughter as a girl, they felt it just made it hard to get through the day in an easy kind of way. And one of the things doesn't quite answer your question, but I think is really telling in relation to it, is people would talk about having strangers apologize, sometimes even apologize profusely, if they misread the child's gender. So it tells you that it really is important to people. They weren't just looking at it as kind of a, oh, oops, but they were saying, oh, my goodness, I'm so sorry.
Hmm. Now, I want to make the point here. You are not arguing that there's anything wrong necessarily with a female having a very strong gender identity as a woman, or a man having a very strong gender identity as a male. It's a matter of them feeling pressured to do things that may not be natural?
Exactly. In fact, if you really could develop the kind of social world where people were less constrained by gender, and I believe we could over time, there might well be people who would just find that the path they wanted to go down, for whatever reason, might take them to a very typically, you know, sort of traditionally feminine place or a traditionally masculine place, or as you say, a strong identity as a male or female, but there would also be room for everyone to pursue whatever interests or capacities they might naturally have. And for people who didn't want to fit in one of those tight boxes also, you know, it's so easy to only think about the people who identify as male or female, men or women, boys or girls. But, of course, we know there are also people who don't want to put themselves in either of those boxes, and there'd be more room for them as well if we could loosen up on and allow for a greater range of gendered possibilities.
So you found that parents tend to see nature and nurture as having varying degrees of influence on their children's gendered behavior and development. Before we talk about that, and this comes back a little bit to what you mentioned earlier, tell us what scholars have concluded about the influence of these two factors on the way people ultimately perceive themselves.
Sure. So the whole kind of nature-nurture debate is where I started in the project. I was really interested to see whether parents primarily thought of gendered outcomes in childhood as fixed in nature, you know, just hardwired boys will be boys, girls will be girls kind of thing, or if they identified a range of social influences. And I'm sure a lot of listeners will be aware that there's been a lot of neuroscience, a lot of biology, a lot of scientific studies lately trying to look at how the male and female brain differ, how boys and girls, men and women differ in various physiological ways. And most sociologists, and I'm a sociologist, would argue that that's not really the key question. It's certainly interesting. It's certainly a worthwhile avenue to pursue. But given how many social influences get layered on, both what we would think of as nurture in the home, but also other influences that you talked about at the beginning of the hour, mass media, influences at school, influences that people pick up in the broader culture, it's really hard to trace back through all of that and ever figure out what's fundamentally natural and inalterable. And so I think part of that either-or framing between nature and nurture may take us in the wrong direction.
Emily W. Kane is my guest. She's professor of sociology and a member of the program in Women and Gender Studies at Bates College in Maine. Her new book is called The Gender Trap: Parents and the Pitfalls of Raising Boys and Girls. You can be part of the conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is sociologist Emily W. Kane. She's a member of the program in Women and Gender Studies at Bates College in Maine and author of the new book, The Gender Trap, Parents and the Pitfalls of Raising Boys and Girls. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. I thought this was fascinating, Emily. Before we even become parents the first time, it seems many of us begin to imagine our relationships with our future children as being inherently different depending on whether we happen to have a boy or a girl. Can you talk a little about how those fantasies play out?
Yes, absolutely. I talk about that idea in the book as gendered anticipation. And one of the questions I asked people at the very beginning of the interviews I did before we got into anything about their current situation with their kids was to ask if they could remember having a preference, whether before they ever became parents or while they were awaiting a child's arrival from birth or adoption or foster care waiting period. And I was really struck by the large proportion of the parents I spoke to who did remember having a preference, often a very strong preference, and all the more so how traditional their reasons for that were, even among parents who were not at all traditional in other ways. So people really seem to imagine that, for example, if they had a girl, if it was a mother, that this would be someone they could shop with, that they could have long emotional conversations with, someone who would stay connected to them forever. And that if they had a son, this is somebody who could carry on the family name. If they were a heterosexual mother, who could be a great companion for dad. Both mothers and fathers, if they imagined a son, were very much anticipating somebody who would enjoy sports, being outdoors, camping, fishing, some of the kinds of activities that we might traditionally think of as male. And it was really striking how much people imagined they'd have a very different person on their hands, depending on whether their child ended up being a boy or a girl.
Is it possible to raise a gender-neutral child?
You know, I think it's probably really difficult in the society that we live in, but I think one can get a lot closer or a lot further from that, depending on what one's ideals are. So when you think about the way most parents you know probably, and certainly most parents I spoke to in my interview study, really want their kids to be able to realize their potential, to pursue what they're passionate about, what seems meaningful to them, to, you know, find their way in the world in a manner that really feels organic to that, to who that child is. And I would argue that the more we can let kids pick that based on their temperament, their personality, the idiosyncrasies of the world in which they're raised, rather than based on whether they happen to be socially identified as a boy or a girl, the more likely they are to find that path that feels meaningful to them. Might not be, like you had mentioned earlier, a gender-neutral path. They might discover along the way that they really like the various social elements we associate with being strongly identified as a woman or strongly identified as a man, but they'd have a lot more choices.
So let's talk about some of the different ways that parents approach the gendering of their own children. You place parents into five categories according to their thinking about all this, starting with the naturalizers, who see gender almost entirely as a product of biology. Is that right?
Exactly. And so these were the parents I most expected when I started the study to be meeting, people who think of gender as natural, as all hardwired, maybe even part of nature's design, but if not, at least just hardwired, hormonally driven. But I also found that those parents reported a lot of actions, sometimes unconscious, sometimes quite conscious, that I would argue reproduced the very same differences that struck them as fixed in nature. So they would often report, for example, giving different opportunities to their sons and daughters or encouraging different activities for their sons and daughters. And they talk about that as if it were just responsive to those natural differences, but it seemed to me, even if that was part of it, that they were also at least amplifying those differences, making them even bigger.
So cultivators are the category that recognize that society and family can shape kids' gender identities, but they are typically comfortable with traditional gender patterns.
Exactly. So this category was folks who see most of the gendered outcomes that we're all familiar with in childhood as pretty much being shaped by society, including themselves and other social influences, media, friends, relatives, peers, etc., and who are very conscious of the actions they take to help craft those outcomes because they feel quite comfortable with them. Although one thing that was interesting to me about this group, they're often people who have kind of a vive la difference kind of attitude, like, oh, it's great for, you know, women to be very different from men. But they also often wanted new kinds of opportunities for their sons and daughters in the work world or in the way they balance work and family that in the end I think are difficult to achieve if you focus so much on differentiating men and women.
Okay, so right in the middle of the list, we have this category called refiners, who both reproduce and resist certain gender expectations. Can you give us some examples of how that might play out in a particular family?
Absolutely. So these were often people who talked a lot about wanting to provide opportunities for their kids all across the spectrum. You know, I didn't want to just buy trucks for him and just buy dolls for her. So people who try to surround their kids with all sorts of different kinds of toys. These were people who often used phrases like, I wanted to expose her to all options and all sides, or I wanted to be sure I took a well-rounded approach in the things I provided for my child. But they were also people who tended to believe in at least some degree of natural gender differentiation. And so if their kids seemed, with those all options laid out before them, to kind of be veering in one direction or another, they tended to view that as an individual choice and to let their child follow that path. So often their children ended up being relatively traditional in how they played out gender.
Now, how do innovators differ from refiners?
So the innovators are the first of two categories I identify of folks who are really trying to push back against typical societal gender expectations actively. You know, not just to say, oh, either way is okay with me, which is more what the refiners were about, but rather trying to say, I'm really trying to push to make sure he tries these things that other boys may not do, or to make sure she tries these things that other girls don't do, or to make sure girls and boys are mixed up together, you know, not so segregated in their activities. So they really were, I use the word innovator, to capture trying to take a new approach to how gender would be put together or structured for their kids.
Is there any less pressure on kids whose parents are innovators, or we'll talk in a minute about resistors, the last category in the spectrum, any less pressure on those kids than on the ones whose parents want them to stick to traditional gender roles?
I think there is less pressure, particularly for the innovators' kids, because though these were people who really wanted to push toward those new possibilities, they were also comfortable with some elements of traditionally gendered activities or attributes or interests for their kids. So though there was some push, and you know, you could argue as soon as parents are pushing anything, they're constraining their kids maybe, but they were also fairly open to some of those traditionally gendered patterns making their way in. And I'd also say because the direction they were pushing is different from the direction that a lot of the rest of the culture pushes, the media and things, that maybe that push isn't so much a constraint as a, you know, another push that could open up a wider range of directions.
So they're sort of like salmon swimming upstream, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. But maybe even opening a little space for their kids to follow upstream if they want to.
Okay, so tell us about the resistors. These are people who tend to defy traditional gender patterns, but do, in fact, worry about potential social consequences for their children.
Yes. So this is a group that, in a way, surprised me, and I heard things like what they told me from lots of people all across the five categories. But what was most striking to me about this group I call the resistors is how much fear and anxiety they felt for their children as their kids are out there navigating their peer worlds, navigating the social world. And these were folks who really wanted to do gender differently, really wanted to push their kids to explore a range of possibilities, push their kids not to identify activities and attributes strongly with, you know, just boy or girl. But they worried a lot about what they would face out there in the world. And a really important element of understanding how these folks I call the resistors felt is that most of them were parenting sons, at least among the kids they had. And one of the really key things I emphasize throughout the book, and that I bet a lot of people have experienced, is that there's a lot more negative social feedback to boys who wander into what we might think of as more typically feminine terrain than there is for girls who want to try out sports, wear typically boyish colors, play with trucks. You know, that there's more acceptance of that socially than boys who want to take ballet or wear pink or carry a baby doll around with them everywhere. And so the resistors were often dealing with boys they wanted to encourage to have that fuller range, and then really worried about their sons being ostracized, picked on, teased, maybe worse.
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting that you found that a lot of mothers actively push their daughters to sort of defy particular gender stereotypes at the same time that a lot of fathers really work hard to make sure that their sons are socialized to fit with traditional gender roles.
Exactly. And it was definitely the fathers, and particularly heterosexual fathers. I talked to both heterosexual parents and gay and lesbian parents. And it was particularly heterosexual fathers who were oriented toward, not all of them at all, but who were oriented toward encouraging those boys, socializing those boys along a pretty narrow and traditional kind of path. And dads were also, like moms, pretty open to seeing their daughters try new things. So it was often that desire to give a broader range to the daughter, but to keep the son in that narrower range, that was a pretty consistent pattern, and one I think tells us something very important about gender and power, because when girls wander into those more socially valued male domains like sports or the opportunity for high-prestige occupations, that's a movement in one direction. But when boys veer out of that territory into, say, some of the nurturing or more emotionally expressive kind of domains that we associate with women, I would argue those are less socially valued.
So you think that that reflects an inherent misogyny throughout the culture?
I would argue that it does, that it's a double standard that treats traditionally male domains as something we should all want to try to find our way into, and traditionally female domains as something we should keep off to the side and expect women to take care of. And this is part of what I mean when I say that some of the parents who wanted to open up those new opportunities for their daughters were, I would argue, just falling back into the gender trap because they're not preparing their sons to go join those daughters in doing the work that needs to be done in our families, in our communities, and in our workplaces.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Jim in Fort Worth. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Great, thanks.
My question is there anything that you would consider to be maybe instinctual, you know, like from when we look at animals and how mating rituals work, how women maybe or female species are maybe more ornamental, or male species are more hunter-gatherer type roles, not always, but is there anything instinctual that maybe we can, might be causing us to act the way we do?
That's certainly an important question, Jim. Thanks. And it's one where my answer would be, I think it's really hard for us to tell. So it's certainly the case that the species needs to reproduce, right, as all do, and that there's an instinct to reproduce. And then I think the big question left for us is, what particular path does that determine for us as a society? And it doesn't seem to me, from the research evidence that I know, that there's any one straight line between that instinctual need and any particular set of outcomes. So, for example, as I'm sure many people know, species vary in terms of whether the male or the female is more ornamental, colorful, because species vary in the way they negotiate that whole sexual attraction that's necessary to keep the species reproducing. And so I don't think it's fixed that our more ornamental approach to femininity is necessarily instinctual. And I would also question whether, even if there is, and it's so hard to say, an instinctual difference in a behavior like nurturance, whether we wouldn't still want to, as a society, encourage everyone to develop nurturant capacities. And there's lots of research evidence to suggest that when men are single parenting, they develop just as nurturant a set of behaviors as women tend to. And so there's some sense in which executing that nurturance may actually be what kind of wakes it up and brings it out in us.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Laura on the line next. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm currently researching gender and music education at Southern Methodist University. And like your speaker, I have found that girls are more encouraged to play gender inconsistent instruments or participate in gender inconsistent activities than boys. And I was wondering what teachers or parents and other adults in these children's lives could do to help encourage boys to also participate in gender inconsistent activities.
Laura, let me interrupt before we get an answer from Emily. When you say gender inconsistent, I don't even know, are girls supposed to play the flute and boys play the tuba? Is that what you're talking about?
That's exactly
okay.
Right.
Okay. What do you think, Emily?
That's a good question too, Laura. I think that it's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. And I think that what parents and teachers need to do is to really try to break down those connections for kids, because part of the reason that kids sometimes think they have something they could teach the teachers or the parents about gender, you know, that if mom and dad and the teacher are saying girls can do anything and kids are saying back, no, not really, it's because their peer worlds often reinforce for them the sense that it's just not safe to leave these zones. So if the teachers and parents can encourage them, absolutely boys can play the flute, or maybe even avoid ever assuming at the start of the music season that the boys are going to stay away from the flute. That could really help.
Emily W. Kane is my guest. She's professor of sociology and a member of the program in Women and Gender Studies at Bates College in Maine. Her new book is called The Gender Trap: Parents and the Pitfalls of Raising Boys and Girls. You can be part of the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Emily W. Kane. She's professor of sociology and a member of the program in Women and Gender Studies at Bates College and author of the book The Gender Trap: Parents and the Pitfalls of Raising Boys and Girls. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. Emily, what does it take for parents to recognize the factors that may have influenced their own gender development? And is this an important process to go through in order to do the right thing for our kids?
I think it really is. And in fact, I think with all of what we've been talking about so far, and part of what I'm trying to convey in the book as well, is that if we stop and question some of the things that we otherwise just take for granted unconsciously, kind of, you know, just by rote, keep on reproducing without ever noticing them, we really can shift the direction of things. So if we think back, regardless of our generation, you know, to what perhaps our parents had as expectations during their childhoods, then what expectations they might have surrounded us with, what expectations we might be surrounding our kids with, those questions along the generations can really make a difference. And some of the parents who I talked to who really wanted to try to shake up gendered constraints and open up more possibilities for kids talked about that very idea, talked about the idea that if they did it a little differently and then their kid did it a little differently, that one parent used the phrase ripple effect, that that could send out a ripple effect for me, to my kids, to their kids' kids, and really get us to a place where people have more individual opportunities.
Is it important to be able to sort of identify which elements of our personalities and our tastes were maybe born to us because that's who we are as a person, and which ones were overlaid upon us? For example, I don't love shopping, but I don't like sports, but you know, I like getting my hair done. And do I need to figure out if those things are because I'm a woman and I was told not to like those things? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, I think the problem is it's so hard to ever figure that out, right? Because in a way, you might be intrigued by your lack of interest in shopping because maybe some of your friends think it's not typical mm-hmm. for a woman. Or at the same time, you might just assume that the fact that you like to get your hair done is because you're a woman. And in fact, I would argue that most people enjoy some of the aesthetic pleasures of color and texture and, you know, creating something beautiful or wearing something beautiful. Most people would or could enjoy that. Mm. And we push women toward that domain, and we tend, not always, but we tend to discourage men, boys and men, from it, where if you could just decide based on what seemed to appeal to you, that would be a lot more possibilities for you.
I know that for this study, you were looking mostly at parents and their expectations for their kids. I'm curious, though, if in your other work you have seen any difference within families based on the sex of each of the multiple children in the family. For example, if there are three boys or three girls, are there different kinds of expectations about gendering than there would be in a mixed gender set of siblings?
Yes, and I wasn't able to look at that, as you note, in this book because I was doing a relatively limited number of very in-depth interviews, but studies that do a wide range of survey interviews, you know, thousands of people, but just a few short questions, do tend to find exactly what you're implying, that, for example, in households with both sons and daughters, it's much more likely that the daughters will get gender-differentiated chores assigned to them.
Hmm.
But in households with all boys or all girls or just a single child, you know, people will be more likely to just assign the chores that need doing. And so children do tend, on average, to have a little bit more traditionally gendered chores if they're in multi-gender households in terms of the siblings. But also, some people have found at least a little effect on who's older as well, like boys with an older sister are a little bit more likely to play with some traditionally girlish things because, you know, that's what's there from their older sister, and they probably in some ways look up to their older sister. So that can make a difference too. And you hear a lot anecdotally about firstborn girls who will say, you know, my dad really wanted a son. I hear this kind of thing from my students a lot, my college students, that my dad really wanted a son, but once I showed up as a daughter, he just decided, that's okay, I'm going to take her to baseball games, I'm going to teach her to play football, I'm going to take her out fishing. So sometimes if the firstborn isn't of that preferred gender, they might actually get taught some of the activities you might associate on the other side. You're much less likely to hear that, though. Again, that double standard I mentioned, much less likely to hear that of a mother who would say, I wanted a daughter, I got a son, so I take him shopping and talk to him about emotions.
So talk about this. It's one thing to have a family where everybody is comfortable with sort of being who you are and not necessarily overlaying gender on top of every single personality trait. It's another thing when you have a child who resists the sort of traditional way of being, and then that kid goes to school and gets mercilessly teased. What do you say to families who are trying to help their children be themselves, stand up for themselves, but are getting a lot of pushback from the rest of the class, the rest of the world?
That's a really hard dilemma, and it's not all that uncommon. And it's one of the things that really interests me in thinking about this whole topic is that any one household really can't change this by itself. And I think a dilemma a lot of parents will recognize is that dilemma where you think, okay, if, you know, your son wants to wear the pink sweatshirt to school, do you want to be the one, if you're comfortable with that, do you want to be the one to say, yes, you can, but people might make fun of you? Or do you want to just let him wear it and have him go discover, you know, are you kind of creating the problem in advance if you stop him, or are you just helping to protect him? And it's so hard to say. And so one of the things that I've come away from the whole project really feeling strongly about is that if everyone who cares about kids, whether they've got them in their household or not, tries to really, as one of my interviewees put it, applaud everything kids do, applaud them whether it's, you know, when they do something good, of course, but applaud them whether it's typical of their gender or not, that then we're more likely to start to create the social atmosphere where that kid who wants to do things differently won't have to worry about being mercilessly teased, or his or her parents won't have to prepare them in advance for that. But I'd also just add, I think a lot of the little routine, everyday reinforcement we do, even if we don't mean to, is part of what makes it so hard for that kid who's different from the expectation when they get out there.
What do you mean by that?
Well, then I think the way we just routinely, for example, praise little girls for how beautiful they look, or praise little boys for how active they are, or, you know, or just say, well, boys will be boys, you know, we know there's nothing that we can do about that, or routinely provide dolls for girls and trucks for boys, that through the accumulation of all those little everyday actions, I'd in fact also say even the kind of everyday actions that assume that kids are going to grow up to be attracted to the other gender. So the, you know, those everyday routine assumptions about that your little girl will someday be a bride and have a groom, or that kind of thing, that along the way then we're just reinforcing these relatively confined boxes that make it seem like all women like to go shopping, all women like to get their hair done, all women like to dress up, and that then make it harder for the boy who'd like to wander around in some of that terrain to do so when the time comes.
Yeah, and what's so interesting about that distinction you're making is that there may be parents who would be totally okay if their son or daughter came to them and said, I'm lesbian or gay, but those subtle signals have said maybe not so much.
Yes, and in fact, that might mean that the child, by the time they get there, wouldn't even feel brave enough to bring it up because the subtle signals seem to be everywhere. And for some people, I think the idea that in a book where I'm interviewing parents of 3 to 5 year olds, the idea that I talk about sexual orientation a fair amount in the book might seem surprising, but in fact, it turns out that especially for boys, many parents make those kinds of connections once they get talking. And one of the connections that some of them made was if their son behaved in ways that they considered too feminine, they wondered if he might grow up to be gay. So even if in a 3 or 4 year old, there was that connection between how they acted out their gender and what was assumed about a much, much later developing sexual orientation.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Sarah on the line now in Plano. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I just wanted to call and let you know that I kind of did my own experiment with my kids. I have 2 girls, and I felt that little girls are maybe encouraged too much to be very feminine, and sometimes it doesn't help you when you grow up and you know, go to work and you have to work with men. So I encouraged my firstborn. I believe I had more time with her than I did the second one. So I focused a lot on, I didn't like Barbies. I had dolls and I played with dolls growing up, but I bought her a doll and all of that, but and she had the tea set and all of that, but I didn't make a big deal about it. I also was encouraging a lot of the academics. I wanted her to know that, because that's how I kind of was brought up, is, well, only boys become the doctors, boys become the engineers, boys are really good at math.
Those are all interesting points, Sarah. Thank you so much for your call. Emily, did you find that other parents who felt like they had been raised in a really traditional family with traditional gender expectations were actually more likely to maybe want to change things with their own families?
I didn't find that they were more likely to, but I definitely found the kind of range that's suggested by what Sarah just shared, that even parents who had been raised more traditionally themselves would often say, I really want there to be more opportunities and possibilities for my daughter than you know, than I felt that there were for me if it was a mother, or that I felt that my mother had, for example, if it was a father. But I would emphasize again that I heard that a lot more often than I heard parents who were saying, I want my son to have significantly more possibilities, say, to explore those things more typically socially viewed as feminine.
What about same-sex parents? Do they feel that they are more comfortable with sort of the range of human experience as related to gender, or do they in fact worry more that somehow their kids will miss out on some critical element of being male or being female?
What I found with the same-sex parents I spoke with was that most of them very much wanted a much more wide-open field of possibilities for their kids, but they expressed the greatest fear and anxiety of any parents I talked to, because in a phrase that one of them used to me, I feel like I've already loaded the dice against my child. In other words, my child already has to deal with a homophobic society coming from a gay family. I want to be careful to be sure he has lots of possibilities, but also that he doesn't end up sort of doubly sanctioned by the world around him. So they were often really nervous about making sure their kids could fit in well enough not to be at risk of a lot of negative social feedback.
Well, I guess that makes sense given that a lot of LGBT parents might have experienced discrimination themselves, and they know how much that stings just to have society disapprove of you for no particular reason. Well, there is a reason, but a reason that many people would reject as being valid.
Exactly, and it's a desire to protect your children and help them have a safe and happy childhood so they can grow up and, you know, make their way in the world. But I also did talk to a lot of parents, gay and straight alike, who really wanted their children to be messengers for a different way of thinking about some of these issues. And there's a lot of hope and, you know, optimistic potential in that kind of framing that I heard from a lot of parents.
So, Emily, what do you recommend to parents who feel like they are fighting an uphill battle to keep their girls out of princess costumes and their boys away from combative video games when the kids seem to want these things?
Yeah, that's such an important question. So I'll shamelessly say you might be interested in reading my book. Some useful thoughts there. But I think one of the most important things we can do is not so much to prevent them from exploring those arenas that are they get so much positive social feedback for, but to make sure we're also opening up spaces for other things as well, to keep more variety and range in what our children are doing. So if some of those video games feel like you've got to let your son spend a little time with them so he knows how to navigate in his world, then also make sure he's spending some of his time getting to explore other kinds of aesthetic pleasures or quieter pleasures. Same thing in the opposite direction for that daughter. Generally speaking, just forbidding it makes it seem all the more fascinating.
Emily W. Kane is professor of sociology and a member of the program in Women and Gender Studies at Bates College in Maine. Her new book is called The Gender Trap: Parents and the Pitfalls of Raising Boys and Girls. Emily, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, Chris. I've enjoyed it.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Janine Kamash answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces our podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can find out what we have coming up on the show and download the podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.